Hello again and welcome to Authors Audio, where we talk to authors from all around the world. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. Today I'm talking with Jesse Browner, an author from New York City. Jesse was born in New York in 1961. When he was 8, his family moved to Europe, where he spent the 70s in high school in London. After he returned to the States to attend Bard College, he then spent his junior year at the University of Leningrad, USSR. He is the author of 4 books: Conglomeros by Random House in 1992, Turn Away in 1996, The Duchess Who Wouldn't Sit Down, An Informal History of Hospitality in Western Civilization, 2003, and his latest novel, The Uncertain Hour, published in May 2007. Jesse is also a literary and diplomatic translator at the UN. I'm happy to welcome Jesse Browner to Authors Audio. Jesse, how you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, Jake.
Yes, it's great to have you on the show, Jesse. You've certainly had an interesting life up to now. You've been educated in the United States and England and also in the USSR at that time, I understand. How exactly did you get into writing?
Almost ever since I can remember, I wanted to write. I began writing when I was very young, 12 or 13. By the time I left college, I knew that was the only thing I ever wanted to do. I was somewhat distracted in my 20s by living a life on the Lower East Side of New York, where I tended to stay out till dawn every morning, and I didn't really focus on what I ought to have been doing. So in the end, my first book did not come out until I was in my late 20s. I was translating French literature at the time for a living. I was very lucky to be able to translate some classic works of the early 20th century. As for who influenced me or what started me, I grew up in England. And in England, when you're studying English literature for your college entrance exams, English is the operative word. You don't read anything but English authors. And I did not read any American authors at all until I was 19 and I moved back to the States. The very first book I read when I came here was Richard Brautigan's Trout Fishing in America.
Okay, yeah.
And it was such a shock to me and so completely new after spending 4 years studying nothing but Dickens and Thackeray and Shakespeare and Lawrence Stern, and it just woke me up to an entire world that I didn't even know existed. So I would say certainly those the beat writers were enormously influential on me, even though in the end I don't write anything like them. It sort of woke me up in a way I feel like I had been sleeping for years before. Not that Dickens and Stern weren't enormously influential. I think when you're a reader, you never read any books the same way again as you did when you were 15 or 16. The passion and intensity and focus that you bring to that reading is very hard to recreate in later life. So I'm not dismissing that at all.
Well, Jesse, we always hear of writers finding their voice. Did it take you a long time to find your own voice in your own writing?
If I found it at all, it's only with the most recent book that I've written. I think I was stumbling for a long time, which is why I said, that I wish I had not entirely wasted my 20s, which should have been serving as a good apprenticeship. Instead, I feel like my 30s were my apprenticeship, and I'm only just finding my footing now. I also write very slowly, so 4 books in basically in 20 years. But this book, The Uncertain Hour, is the first time I feel as if I finally started on the path that I should have been on all this while. I can't regret it. I certainly don't repudiate my earlier books, but I feel as if they were groping for a style and a substance that I've only just begun to master. I'm very happy to have done it at all. I think there are plenty of people who don't do it at all, so I feel very lucky.
How did you get to this very interesting place, AD 66 in Rome? What inspired you to go there?
Well, I'll tell you, the book that I wrote before this was my only nonfiction book. It's a book called The Duchess Who Wouldn't Sit Down, which is a history of hospitality in Western civilization. And it's very anecdotal. I take 10 stories ranging over a course of about 3,000 years, and I create for each chapter, those stories serve as the nugget to explore various aspects of hospitality. When I did my chapter on ancient Rome, during the course of my research, I came across this story, The Uncertain Hour, is based on an ostensibly true historical event that took place in the year 66. And I wrote about it in that book, and I found after the book was done that I couldn't quite shake the story. The central character is the historical figure Petronius, who wrote the novel The Satyricon, and he has been ordered by the Emperor Nero to commit suicide, and on the night of his suicide, he throws a banquet for his close friends. That banquet is the central feature of The Uncertain Hour, which only takes place over the course of about 12 hours. Right up until just before Petronius' suicide. And I just could not, for some reason, my exploration of the story in the history book just did not leave me satisfied. I knew that there was more to say, and I knew even before I finished writing the book that this one would be my next one. I've never written historical fiction before. In some ways, I almost don't think of this as a historical novel because it's stripped so bare of historical detail. My thought was more that it could be a dinner party of thoughtful intellectuals almost any time in history, and in some ways I modeled it more on dinners that I've had out in the Hamptons than on anything that I imagine really took place in ancient Rome.
And are you working on a new book at the moment?
Yes, I am. I can't tell you very much about it because I'm just at the very earliest stages.
Yes. You don't want to jinx it, for sure.
It's not even that. I don't like to set it down in stone because it's so fluid at the moment. It could go almost anywhere. And any time I talk about it, it sort of tends to petrify it in that description. Suffice to say, it's very, very different from The Uncertain Hour, but I hope I've taken all the lessons I learned writing this book and going to apply them and expand them in the next. I'm also working on some non-fiction projects, including a history of cooking that I hope to be doing for the Oxford University Press in the form of recorded podcasts.
Well, as a writer today, you mentioned the Beats and all that period of time, and I've certainly, you know, read all of them or most of them, and I found that time a particularly interesting time in American writing. How do you feel about these times we're in now? Is there a lot of exciting work out there that is maybe not as well known as it should be?
I think there's more work out there than there's ever been at any time. On the internet, through blogging. This is not a time where traditional forms are necessarily being respected. But at the same time, because of that, I feel like we're in a transitional moment. Work that I'm reading by Spanish language writers right now is very exciting to me. The so-called B-list writers are sort of being shut out of traditional publishing, and they're finding new venues everywhere, and it's very hard to keep track of them all.
You're also a professional translator, both literary translator and diplomatic translator in the UN, correct?
That's right.
How did that all happen?
I didn't have my first job until I was in my late 20s or 30. I earned a living as a translator. I was translating mostly French surrealists. I was very lucky. I got to translate Cocteau and Dumas and Breton. I translated Rilke. And, well, one night I met a man at a party, which is how it often happens here in New York. And he had a freelance job at the UN, and he suggested that it was very easy work and great money. And I went in, and I met with them, and I started working for them. And shortly after that, it's the kind of job that's only offered if you take the civil service exam. And at the time, the civil service exam had not been offered for 10 years, but there was one coming up, so I took it. Why not? And the fact is, back then, this is going back a long ways, before the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the UN was very, very quiet. Everything was being handled behind the scenes by the U.S. and the USSR. And I had a full-time job, and I hardly worked. You know, sometimes I would work 3 hours in a month and still get paid. Now, for a writer, you know, writers have a hard enough time making a living. It was manna from heaven. And although, you know, things have gotten a lot busier of late, it's still a spectacular job for a writer to have. You know, I don't take my work home with me. You know, it's not a traditional way for a writer to make a living, but it can be very interesting. You know, I work in the Security Council, translating speeches and editing speeches, preparing the official record, sort of like the equivalent of the congressional record for the UN. So on occasion, it's very interesting. It can also be like, you know, any diplomatic speech. They can be repetitive and uninformative. But, you know, we all have to make a living, and you don't raise a family in New York City writing literary fiction, I can assure you.
Right. I was just going to ask you, as far as your work habits as a writer, are they, do you write every day? Do you have a set amount of work that you like to write every day, or how does that work for you?
Well, generally speaking, when I'm writing, I tend to get up very, very early in the morning, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and put in 3 hours before I wake my children up and get them ready for school. I've always found that the early morning is when my mind is the freshest. And if I have time later in the afternoon, I tend to do most of my UN work in the hours between breakfast and lunch. If I have time in the afternoon, then I'll go back over what I've written during the day. I like as much as I think most writers are creatures of habit. They like to do the same thing every day. And for me, because I am at the beck and call of the Secretary General, I have to arrange my hours around him. And the only way I can be certain of getting regular hours is by waking up that early. And I enjoy it, I have to say. It's nice when the city's quiet.
Oh, yeah, especially New York.
Yeah.
Most people know New York has a magic all its own.
It certainly does. It certainly does. I'm a fourth generation New Yorker. I only live a mile from where my great grandfather first lived when he first arrived in this country. So I feel as if you know, the city for me is very much a cradle of my imagination and my identity, and I find it very inspiring. And you know, there aren't that many of us who have this sort of historical background here. So it's nice, especially having grown up abroad, it's nice to live in a place that I can really call home.
Absolutely, Jesse. Could you describe your four books very briefly for our listeners so they can have a little peek into your work?
Oh, great. Yes, my very first novel, which I published when I was, I suppose, 30, I'd been writing it through my mid-20s, is called Conglomerus. Now, that is kind of a, I suppose you might call it a Frankenstein story of sorts. There was, at one point in my life, I stumbled on a Romanian surrealist painter named Victor Browner, This has the same last name as me, spelled differently, but my family was originally from the same part of Romania, and I assumed that he and I were related. In the course of researching him, I came across a sculpture of his called Conglomerus, which was a kind of an anthropomorphic monster. And the book speculates that the monster was not a figment of his imagination, but an actual creature that he encountered in the forests of the Carpathian Mountains. And the narrator of the book becomes convinced that this is so, and he travels to Romania, and he finds the Conglomerus, and he brings it back to the United States, where he sets about educating and civilizing it. And so the story is obviously the story of that disaster. You know, a story like that can't possibly end happily, and indeed it doesn't. No. The second novel, which I published in my mid-30s, is called Turn Away. And that is set here in New York City. Almost all parts of New York City are islands, except for the Bronx, which is the only part attached to the mainland. And off the east coast of the Bronx is a series of small islands. The largest of them is City Island. The rest are very small, rocky islands. And my island, Turnaway, the title of the book, is a fictional island set among the real islands. And it posits that the sole inhabitant of that island is a man who fancies himself the last descendant of the Lenape Indian tribe that once occupied all of New York City and Westchester. And the narrator of the book is someone who is shipwrecked on that island, and the story tells of their friendship and of how the narrator lures this man from his hideaway on the island and brings him to Manhattan. So I suppose in some ways it's kind of a reiteration of the first book, the corruption of the innocent and the self-delusion of would-be do-gooders. And then my third book, is the history book, The Duchess Who Wouldn't Sit Down. And as I said, that covers 3,000 years of Western hospitality from ancient Sumeria to Hitler in his country house. And then the last, The Uncertain Hour, which was just published this year, and tells the story of the suicide banquet of Petronius.
Yes. I'm just wondering if there's something in your book, the latest book, The Uncertain Hour, that you might want to read briefly for our audience.
Sure. I'd be very happy to. This is a passage where Petronius is walking through his darkened house late at night. This is several hours before his death. And he's walking from one room to the other. And here we go. The granite slabs of the dark hallway were cold against his bare feet and silent, absorbing all sound like a tomb. Petronius thought of his own tomb, dark and ungiving like this, wherein he would be laid tomorrow. He felt, impatiently with himself, as if he were already his own ghost, wandering the subterranean halls that connected his vault to the rest of the necropolis, the Temple of Apollo, the Acropolis, and ultimately to the Cave of the Sibyl, and its hidden entrance to the underworld. How long would he wander, padding silently like this, searching for the way out? Months? Years? Having crossed the threshold, would he even remember what it was he was supposed to be looking for, or who he was or had been? He paused and allowed the chill to seep up into the bones of his feet. There would be no ache like this, of that he was reasonably certain, and possibly no sensation of any kind, no sense of pressure, weight, temperature, humidity, breath entering and leaving the body, light pushing against the ragged edges of shadow. The very walls and archways, perhaps, would seem as insubstantial as mist, translucent and shifting, their layout arbitrary and mystifying. What purpose could they serve to a spirit who can walk in a straight line through mountains and seas, through the center of the earth? And yet he was quite convinced that he would be wandering them dutifully this time tomorrow, that even in the days of the newly dead, he would somehow recognize the patterns they traced, their dim echo of some immutable law of nature, as a newborn bird somehow knows to open its beak skyward to receive its first meal. Yes, surely the dead have instincts to guide them through their new world, and quite probably they heed those instincts the way animals in this world heed theirs, with unthinking trust, instead of ignoring and despising them the way living men do. But do they have memories?
Yes, thank you so much, Jesse. That was wonderful. And that's been Jesse Browner reading from his book, new book, The Uncertain Hour, which you can have a look at and purchase through his website. And we will have links to that also. And this has been another edition of Authors Audio. And I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. Until next time, keep dreaming and happy reading.